Checkerfin. Checkerfin.
Porter was always in my head.
Checkerfin. Checkerfin.
Yes.
Rich the Education Gadfly.
Sex, sex.
Mike and Rick tell you
early college, high school.
Know about
pain and suffering.
Learning and teaching.
In your face, in your face,
your
face.
Listen to your words that they be preaching. Cause here's the Education Gadfly show. Yeah.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here with my guest co-host from Education Sector, Kevin Carey.
Hello, Michael.
Hello, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You know, I was just thinking that you are really much taller than Rick Hess.
Well, I'm bigger than Rick in a lot of ways, intellectually, taller, all kinds of ways. So yeah, you've got the...
Zing. Yeah, but you know, when you meet Rick Hess in person, you don't think of him as a short man. I mean, people probably think of me as a short man because I'm you know, vertically challenged. I'm okay with that. That's part of my Italian ethnicity. I'm not ashamed of that. But Rick comes across as a big presence. But if you look at Rick, he's not that tall.
I think people mistake Rick's personality and his presence in the education policy conversation with his. They assume that he must have size to match.
I see. Now, Kevin, we're very excited to have you on the show, not just because you were such a great contributor last time you were here, but because, you know, there's been a little bit of tension lately between those of us here at Fordham and Education Sector because you have been getting into it a little bit, or maybe I should say more accurately, Liam has been getting into it with you on the blogosphere. Are there any words you'd like to say to Liam, who's unfortunately not with us here
today? Well, apparently, I believe Liam is right now probably composing some kind of lengthy broadside attack on our blog. And in fact, has sworn to spend his entire summer doing nothing other than... Yeah. Read the Quick and the Ed, that's www.quickanded.com, and respond. And so,
And I have to tell you, I'm a little upset about this, Kevin, because it's really hurt his productivity and all the rest of his job he's supposed to be doing.
It's actually part of our strategy to sort of minimize the productivity of our think tank rivals.
Yes.
So it's it's working out great.
Yeah. I have to say, it is hard to find a better time waster than writing a blog.
No, it's certainly true. Maybe reading a blog.
That might be the other one. Okay. Well, it's summertime, but yet we still have plenty to discuss here today. We're going to play a game of Pardon the Gadfly. Then we're going to have our Research Minute with Amber Winkler. And we'll have some education news of the weird. So, Christina, let's get us started with Pardon the Gadfly.
Topic one. The Chicago Times reports that suburban parents want to pick specific teachers for their children. Should this be allowed?
Well, under some circumstances, you could see a situation where a particular teacher's approach might match up with a particular student's learning style. But basically, this is mostly about fair allocation of resources. You know, we think about resources in education in terms of financial terms, dollars per student, but the real resource is teachers. That's what we spend most of our money on. Teachers are very important. They vary a lot in terms of their quality. We wish they were all better, but right now we have the teachers we have. And so it's critical that teachers are distributed in an equitable way. And if we let parents exert too much influence on that process, inevitably what happens is that the parents who themselves have the time and the inclination to really go in there and angle for the best students for their children will win, and other students will kind of get left out in the cold. It's bad policy. It needs to be resisted.
See, Kevin, I totally disagree with you on this one because I feel like we're sending such a mixed message to parents. On the one hand, our education system complains all the time that parents are not involved enough. They like to blame parents for all the ills. And then you have a case where parents are on the ball. They do their research. They find out which teachers might be a best fit for their kid, and they try to get that information across to the schools and lobby on behalf of their kids' interests. And we say, "Oh, you parents, you know that's not fair. You're gonna unfairly hurt the kids who don't have parents like you." I just think that message is not helpful. I think the message we should send to all parents is be an advocate for your child. And, you know, just because parents might have to, you know, work an extra job or be poor, let's teach them how to be strong advocates too, instead of somehow being angry at the parents who do this kind of thing on behalf of their kids.
Well, again, best fit is one thing. But if it's just simply about a generalized difference in quality between teachers, then fairness requires us to distribute that quality in an equitable way.
Mm-hmm.
Topic two. Baltimore's mayor, Sheila Dixon, has floated the idea of mayoral control over Charm City schools. Is this a smart idea?
In Baltimore right now, this is not a smart idea. You look at the press coverage of the mayor's accounts, and what she's basically saying is that the new superintendent, who's really come in hard charging, trying to shake things up, is making too much change. He's changing things too fast. And it seems like he has made some people angry, particularly at the central office, because he has tried to shift authority and money from the central office out to the schools. And some of those central office bureaucrats are angry, and they've petitioned the mayor to do something about it. I think what this shows is that mayoral control can cut both ways. It can be very helpful for school reform if you have the right mayor. It can also hurt school reform.
Well, I agree with Mike in this case. It's mayoral control is attractive, and it seems to have worked in a lot of cities. Certainly here in D.C., it's obvious that mayoral control is having a big positive effect on the schools. New York, Boston, Chicago, lots of places this has worked. But it has to be the right mayor. It has to be the right kind of control. What you really need is to have someone, whether it's a mayor or city council, some important politician that is directly accountable to the electorate, take responsibility for the schools in a very meaningful way, and then have that responsibility translated into authority to make tough choices.
But Kevin, is that really it? Is it accountability, or is it just simply that we have to have somebody who is not beholden to the teachers' unions overseeing the schools? I mean, that the problem with school boards in many cases is that they become captured by the teachers' unions or other adult interests like central office bureaucrats. Isn't that the relation?
I think that's a narrow lens. Being captured by anybody is a problem, but I'm not sure that's always been the problem that mayoral control has come in to solve.
Okay, well, I think we have a chance to talk some more about the teacher unions. Christina, topic number three.
All right, Denver's first in the nation merit pay program is in trouble. The district wants to make some sensible changes, but the union won't allow it. Does this prove that you just can't work with local teachers' unions?
Do you like our leading questions, Kevin?
Yeah. Well, no, it doesn't prove that. I mean, the question of, it's a bit like asking whether, you know, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. We have to work with local teachers' unions. Whether you think you can or you can't, we have to. So sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's not. The Denver reform has been held up as a model of management union collaboration on what I think people agree are some interesting and certainly different approaches toward teacher compensation. If that collapses, it will send a bad message. It will be unfortunate. But in the long run, the only way I think that we can really do this constructively is to negotiate with teachers, because after all, it's their jobs we're talking about.
See, I don't agree that we have to work with the teacher unions necessarily. We can push to create lots and lots more charter schools, for example, that don't have teacher unions. We could push for school vouchers and push for more choice in private schools that don't have teachers unions. So, I think it's just important that we not say to the unions, you know what, you're always going to have veto power, you're always going to have this authority, and if you don't like something, well, we'll just have to negotiate with you. I think we have to keep the pressure up on them by saying, look, if you're going to be unreasonable, if you're not going to accept some very sensible reforms, then we will continue to go around you if that's what it takes.
I don't think de-unionization is really a viable strategy for a lot of reasons. One, it's not going to happen. Two, we can't disempower teachers in these processes. If we were to go toward an all-charter school environment, teachers will still have a voice. And if they don't, they ought to. And so we still need to work with them.
Yeah, teachers should have a voice. I just don't think they have much of a voice in their unions today. And you do have places like D.C. where, 25% of the population is now going to schools that have been de-unionized.
Right.
So I think it could be 50. Well, I think it could be 75.
You can have unionized charter schools too. I mean, just because they don't have unions now doesn't mean they couldn't in the future.
Well, let's hope that doesn't happen, in my opinion. Okay. Well, good. Kev, this is so much fun because we actually have some disagreements here. I suspect our listeners appreciate that.
I hope so.
I always tell Rick, I just want you to pretend, that you're left of center, but he's never willing to do it.
That's not Rick.
So I often pretend that I'm left of center, and over time, I've become more left of center.
Sometimes I think you're not pretending.
Yeah, exactly. I forget that I'm pretending. It's a role I take too well. Well, Kevin, since you last were here on the show, we've started a new segment with Amber Winkler, our research director, the Research Minute.
You search, research, research. It's the Gadfly Research Minute.
Welcome back to the show, Amber. What's the topic this week?
Thank you. Well, lots in the newspaper this week about this new study that came out. The study is called Gender Similarities Characterize Math Performance. It appeared in Science magazine. The study was funded by the National Science Foundation, and basically, in a nutshell, we've got researchers from the University of Wisconsin and UC Berkeley who found that there's no longer a difference between the math performance of boys and girls. They score alike one another in math. This is surprising to some, since we've typically had a stereotype that boys are better at math than girls.
30 seconds.
And they studied 7 million students in 10 states. The states were geographically diverse, and they appear representative of other states in terms of their NAEP scores, so that's good as far as reliability goes. They found that girls were taking more math in high school than they used to, which they hypothesized may be a factor, but real quickly, before we celebrate too much, we might got to point out one other thing. The women are still underrepresented in the STEM careers, the engineering and whatnot careers. More variance in boys' scores, which basically means that you've got more boys scoring at the very highest levels of the academic curve and scoring at the low levels. So mixed news, but overall good news. Hence our song for the week by the Cheetah Girls called Girl Power.
Amber, well done. Right. So, you know what?
Am I making the minute or am
I
going?
You came very close. That was about... You know, Amber, you came very close to making the minute this time. You were a little bit over, but that's okay. That's okay.
I couldn't leave out that variance in the boys' scores because that was really an important point that got it left out in some of the news accounts.
Thank you for saying that. It did get left out.
That's the Larry Summers point. Everyone says Larry Summers has been refuted, but if that's true, then that's essentially what he was trying to say.
Right, because let's say it. Okay, let's say it again. Because what the finding was that the very highest level in the 99th percentile, you had twice as many boys as girls at that level. Those, you would think, are the students who would go on to perhaps be in academia in some of the math and science fields, again, which would be Lauren Summers' point. So, I mean, how do you make sense of that, Amber?
Yeah, I mean, I have to point out the study, if you actually paid the $10 to download it, which was what Science Magazine charges you.
We did pay it because we are a serious research organization.
Yes, we did. Actually, you know, Fordham owes me $10. But anyway,
we're good for it.
She just showed the statistics for Minnesota. And I was a little concerned that, you know, by using that illustrative example in Minnesota, that it wasn't actually representative of what they found in the other states. But regardless, I mean, obviously, I think it's good news that we've got girls scoring similarly than boys.
On average. Right?
On average, yeah. But you still got this other thing of, you know, the boys kind of outnumbering the girls at those really higher levels. So, you know, it is what it is.
Well, doubtless girls catching up to boys will be taken as evidence for the alleged boys crisis.
Yes.
Wrongfully so.
And let me ask you this. I mean, maybe I'm way off base, and I know other talk radio hosts have gotten in trouble talking about autism lately. So I don't want to tread into those waters without care. But isn't it true that boys are much more likely to have forms of autism than girls are? And that sometimes autism, you know, one of the markers is that while, you know, boys might have various problems with socialization and things, that sometimes they're incredibly good at math. You know, this is sort of the Rain Man stereotype. Mm-hmm. And that there, again, that there could be, I mean, that there's something going on here that at the extreme end of the boy spectrum, there might be something about the brain that's leading to this high achievement in mathematics.
Could be, wasn't a part of the study in particular, but I'm all about your hypotheses, Mike.
Right.
You always got some creative ones.
yes, creative. And that's why we now have a real research director here to keep us based. Okay, thank you, Amber Winkler, with her Research Minute. Well, it's now that time, Kevin, the time that we wait for all week long, education news of the weird time. With our special correspondent, intern Amy. Intern Amy, what's weird this week?
On the first day of school this year, students violating the Gonzales Independent School District's new dress code will be sent home and asked to return with appropriate clothing and a parent. After the first day, however, students in violation in the Gonzales, Texas District will be provided with dark blue jumpsuits and required to return to school the following day.
You're making that up.
No.
Really?
They look just like Michael Myers from the Halloween movies. After three offenses requiring a jumpsuit, the behavior will be considered disruptive and a defiance of school authority and will entail punishment above and beyond the parental escort and clothing inspection. This new stricter dress code and enforcement policy has already received responses, both good and bad, from teachers, students, parents, and administrators. The senior class president said, "I talked to some of my friends about it, and they said they're not going to obey the dress code just so they can wear the jumpsuits." Many other students said they'd rather wear orange jumpsuits like prisoners than abide by the new dress code, which disallows cargo pants, t-shirts, and everything shorter than Bermuda shorts. Even teachers question the ability of the school district to implement it, saying that it will require teacher solidarity to accomplish what the school board intends. Some parents and teachers, however, think it will make life easier. Teacher Jane Eiley said it will make determining whether or not a student is dressed inappropriately simpler, while a parent from a neighboring district with a similar policy says it makes it easier for her sons to get dressed in the morning. Other parents, however, are questioning the timing of the decision, saying they've already done their back-to-school clothes shopping and now their kids can't wear anything they bought. They've even started a petition. One concerned parent wrote a letter to the Gonzales Inquirer asking, "As I understand it, all shirts have to have sleeves and collars, and skirts have to come to a certain spot on a girl's leg. What happens on Fridays when the cheerleaders show up in their uniforms?" And that's Education News of the Weird.
Wow. Excellent question about the cheerleaders, don't you think, Kevin?
Yeah, that's tough. If you guys had that policy here, Rick would be in a jumpsuit next week.
He would be in a jumpsuit, which I actually think would be great. We could put that on the blog. People would enjoy seeing that. Is this just another way that our schools are becoming like prisons, Kevin?
Well, I'm actually pretty sympathetic to these dress code ideas. I mean, the way people you see people dressing these days, I think it probably can have a negative effect on the seriousness of the learning environment. I don't know if the jumpsuit's the way to go.
Now, let me get this straight, though. Bermuda shorts. I mean, these are long shorts, right? I mean, they go down to what?
Knee length.
I mean, I have to admit, I have never bought into this long shorts thing. I mean, if I'm going to wear shorts, I want them to be, you know, relatively short. Now, I'm not talking about super short, but I mean, you know, back in, I don't know, the 90s, you could wear shorts that were like, you know, above your knee, and that wasn't considered scandalous. And so you're now saying that kids can't wear, I mean, I don't know, like a soccer shorts that go above your knee, that'd be out. I'm not sure that's good for PE. Either.
No athletic pants at all, actually.
No athletic pants at all?
Well, if you're in favor of school uniforms, then I guess the principle applies, right?
Well, I think there's some tension here between this and the obesity epidemic, that if we want our kids exercising, they should be allowed to come dressed in athletic wear.
If only they had locker rooms in the schools where you could change clothes.
Exactly. That would be helpful. But yeah, they're cutting those too, you know. It's all part of the narrowing of the curriculum.
That's right.
All right. Well, thank you, intern Amy, for an excellent Education News of the Weird. And thank you, Kevin, for coming over here and being part of our show.
Glad to.
All right. Hope you'll come back sometime. Until next time.
I'm Kevin Carey.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.